Support for Boston Public Radio comes from North Shore Music Theater. Audiences can experience the true story and musical journey of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. Jersey Boys comes to Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater May 7th through May 19th. Tickets at nsmt.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Mardrigan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. With less than a month, just actually several weeks until the Brexit deadline, Brits are stockpiling food and they're hoarding French wine, taking advantage of France's low alcohol taxes while they can. But is this about saving money or about having enough booze on hand to drink the Brexit blues away? Joining us to talk about this and another exit, that would be Mario Batali's departure from the restaurant industry. And other headlines at the intersection of food policy and food culture is Corby Comer. Corby's a senior editor at The Atlantic, an award-winning food writer, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy. Hello, Corby Comer.
Hello there.
How are you?
Good, and you?
So Mario Batali was accused of sexually assaulting and harassing women in his restaurants, and he admitted to a lot of this. And apparently he's out of his restaurants. What does that mean for Italy up the street? What does that mean for his restaurants?
It means he's been forced to sell all of his shares in his businesses by his partners because having him around makes it a tainted property. They are worried about losing sales. In fact, after the accusations against Mario Batali came out in December of 2017, the Sands Casino Group shut down six of the restaurants that the Batali-Bastianich Group had been running. So this was a big blow to the bottom line, and they decided he has to go, and they bought him out.
You know, speaking of the Bastianich group, I had Lydia Bastianich, who obviously everybody knows, on TV with me right after this thing broke, and I asked if she or anybody in her family knew these horrible things about Mario Batali, and here's what she had to say.
I was devastated. I knew, you know, they like to have their drinks at night, they're socialized, but, you know, boys will be boys, and Italian men like to have their drink and get together. But I was not aware of his long hands and what he was doing.
Back in already. Should he get back in?
He needs to settle that. I think he needs time. That needs a lot of time to settle it and with God and with himself.
Now, her son is obviously much more intimately involved, or was much more intimately involved with Batali's business. Is it credible, as he suggests in the New York Times, that he knew nothing about this as well?
It's not credible that he knew nothing about it. It is credible that he didn't know about the specific allegations because he wasn't there, because he didn't wake up with a woman who said she was assaulted while she was drunk and passed out. It is credible that he didn't see the specific allegations, not that he wasn't aware of or heard about the pattern of behavior.
Do you know Batali?
Of course I do, yeah.
I know we've discussed this before, but I have to say, in response to the Me Too stuff, if I had to rank the most clueless responses, he did a written apology at the end of which he included a recipe for pizza cinnamon rolls or some such thing, which showed me that he had no understanding, at least at that time, about how serious the allegations were. Am I wrong about that?
It was clumsy, ham-handed, and stupid, especially stupid in retrospect. But the idea that he thought it would just go away because he didn't think that the accusations were particularly credible or difficult, or maybe he didn't remember the behavior.
Or that it was pretty much the norm for the industry.
Well, excuse me. It's better than calling the women liars, which is what a lot of the men who have been accused have done.
That's true.
So I would give him points for not doing that.
But let me shift the subject. It's not a big shift. But we discussed recently my pal Brett Anderson at the New Orleans Times-Picayune, who broke up in the story about John Besh, recently had another story, pretty much just as bad, about a guy who has a chain of successful pastry shops called Sucre for Sugared in New Orleans. And Brett, the reporter, was unable to get Whole Foods in hearing a whole series of credible accusations that this guy had lots of sexual relationships with female employees and threatened them if they talked about it. Sex parties at his pool with employees while married. And then saying, you have to not talk about this. It's going to be bad for me, bad for you. And then Whole Foods saying, you know, sorry, we like the products. Why are you bothering us? We're just not going to reply. Same thing with the airport in New Orleans, which has cute little Sucre boutiques. And a woman executive saying, I had to leave town because everybody's now just deciding they want this to blow over and they're sick of it. And that, I think, is the real concern with these stories now, that there's fatigue, everybody's tired of it. You know, I'm sure Brett himself and the reporters of the Times, they're getting tired of reporting this beat. You know, it is going to go away, and that's the tragedy of it. But Mario probably thought it would go away quickly.
So we're talking to Corby Cummer. So, Corby, while the conventional wisdom is this Me Too affliction was about as horrible in the restaurant industry as virtually anywhere, it appears that mental health concerns are about as serious in the restaurant industry as in practically any. Why is that? What makes it different from other industries that creates an environment where mental health concerns are so severe?
It's drug addiction. It's alcoholism. It's general forms of abuse. And why is this? It's an insecure industry. It doesn't have regular salaries. It doesn't have health insurance. It doesn't have kind of the guarantees and social safety net that a lot of other employers have. It's what, the largest employer, largest employment sector in the country? It's open to anybody who will show up. So it's huge. So the fact that there's so many more numbers means that there will be more problems just numerically. But it's also the insecurity of it. It's the late hours. It's the lack of outlets like general physical fitness because people are unavailable in the hours or the gyms aren't open when they get off work.
And so this restaurateur who started this I Got Your Back thing, I never know if those things are PR efforts or if this is a sincere effort to help heal those who need healing. Is it sincere?
So this was a piece, I don't know, about a Sacramento restaurateur. Sacramento had this rash of, there are copycat suicides, mm-hmm. as we know, it's this grisly, horrible phenomenon. Sacramento had them within the food and beverage industry, and this is a piece that does make this guy look awfully good and maybe preening a restaurateur who had a very locally popular spot in Sacramento, already a state capital full of backroom politics. He literally has a back room in a restaurant which is full of influential politicians, and he said, you have to get together. We all have to help the restaurant community and mental health. So whether or not it's bogus, he's bringing national attention to this problem. There's a woman who's a writer and editor named Kat Kinsman, and she's a terrific, funny writer who does Extra Crispy and various websites. She's had lots of media experience, but she herself has suffered from depression, written a book about depression and anxiety. She started a much more below-the-radar web support space for chefs who had depression. And that's the kind of effort that I think is necessary because it's not calling attention to herself, mm-hmm. as this guy kind of mm-hmm. arguably is. It's saying, I want the chef community to understand we know that mental illness is a big problem and depression and, of course, these terrible working conditions in kitchens that led to the kind of abuse we were just talking about.
We're talking to Corby Cummer, our food guy.
So, Corby Cummer, this is another really sad story about people who are down on their luck. More than half the people who rely on Supplemental Security Assistance Program, or SNAP, run out of money in the first 2 weeks after benefits are issued every month.
Oh, sure. I mean, this is a well-known phenomenon. We've talked about it here. We'll continue to talk about it. Walmart and other stores are completely prepared for the onslaught. It's usually the last day of the month, I think, when the SNAP benefits arrive. And then they know, and food pantries know, that the last week of the month is when they will have an influx of people because they've run out of their food assistance. But there are new bills in Congress. There's a bill from Amy Adams, a Democrat from North Carolina, and she's hoping that New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand will introduce a companion bill to try to get better nutritional standards for SNAP, or rather a better thumbnail for a diet. So a woman in the late 70s sued the USDA saying, you're not giving me enough money for your so-called healthy diet. And when this was established in, I think, 1964, the Food Stamp Act, it said you have to provide enough money to buy a nutritionally adequate diet. This woman said, who are you kidding? This is not enough money for a nutritionally adequate diet.
$38 a week.
Government being government, rather than decide from scratch what would be a healthy diet, they said, let's say that the USDA, the dairy supplements that we're giving you because they're surplus food, We're going to call them healthy. So they established this strange thrifty food plan that said if you have 3 cups of milk a day for a woman and you have a lot of beans, then you're just fine. And, of course, completely unrealistic.
2 things about this. One, since we're so critical of politicians so often on this show, Jim McGovern, who is now chair of the House Rules Committee, has, through the years, done so much wonderful work. I know you're nodding in agreement on food stuff.
National hero.
Including, he does that thing that a decent number of politicians do, is for a week live on a food stamp budget, proving it's unbelievable. And, Corbett, you may or may not know this story. I don't know if I've told you this before. Is a couple of years ago, we had somebody in, and I'm embarrassed to say, I can't remember who it was, who was doing the same thing. She was on that budget for a week to prove how you can't sustain yourself.
The SNAP challenge.
And right, exactly. And she brought in bread she had baked herself and hummus she had made herself. And it was clear she didn't have enough food for the week, but she laid it out for us in the studio so we'd understand. So even though she didn't have enough food for the week, it looked so delicious. Do you know what happened? Marjorie ate it.
Well, I didn't understand.
Well, you actually did.
I took the food out of her mouth.
You did. Marjorie ate the bread and the hummus.
I didn't understand.
Which was her food SNAP challenge for the week.
She was just kind of bringing this as a demo. I didn't realize this was her food to last through the weekend.
How was it, by the way?
It was delicious. It was delicious. It was very embarrassing.
So even if he was ham-handed and incredibly clumsy and offering cinnamon rolls made with pizza dough, Mario spent a week with his whole family on the SNAP challenge.
Did he really?
And he very carefully documented which it was Key Foods. So he went to the lowest price market. He got a lot of pork, and he found the meat that was on sale, the beans that were on sale. But every piece about SNAP and the ridiculously low budget will say, family makers don't have time to prepare beans. Mm-hmm. Yes, they might be very nutritious, but they don't know how, and they're not going to make them. So the point of this bill is there were a bunch of possible plans outlined after this woman sued USDA for saying not enough money, not nutritionally adequate. And all they're trying to do, the women introducing this bill in the House and the Senate, is to say ratchet it up to the next most expensive diet per week, because it already exists, and all we're saying is $4 more a week. You already have it in place. Just eliminate that ridiculous thrifty food plan, the lowest echelon, and bump up to the next one.
You know, for those of you who are math impaired, this is $5 a day.
$5 a day.
We're talking to Corby Cummer.
So, Corby Cummer, we always talk about the terrible toll that plastics are taking on the environment, that horrible thing out in the middle of the ocean where all this plastic is swirling around. Trader Joe's phasing out single-use plastics nationwide. They said in the story that Trader Joe's alone produces 1 million pounds of plastic every year. And you were saying, I don't think a lot of people are aware of this. I wasn't sure of this either, that you can throw plastic into the big blue bins, the single...
Can in Cambridge. I don't know how widespread that is.
I don't know how widespread it is either.
You know, I'm so glad that you're going to save familiar relations with my stepdaughter, who, when I put plastic bags and yogurt cups and stuff that might not have the recycling sign on it into the blue bin, says, you have to sort that all out. No, in Boston, we have mixed-use recycling.
Beautiful.
So what is this? It's, by the way, a European idea. The Europeans are now outlawing single-use plastics. So Starbucks had to completely refit its cups. So does Dunkin', because they had, even though they were cardboard, they weren't recyclable because they had this funny plastic lining you don't see. So this is just outlawing it, and Trader Joe's is proactively saying, we're not going to have them.
Is it true, I find it hard to believe, that McDonald's is a trendsetter in this space? Is that true?
Yes. McDonald's has been a trendsetter in animal welfare and animal rights. So while they are increasing the fat and sodium for the same amount of money and ruining people's health, to put it just a little gently, they are being very good about animal rights and the environment.
Yeah. Well, kill the people, save the planet. I think it's a good motto.
So can we move on to my favorite story because I can relate to this? There's a story. I don't even know where we're getting it from. The people who eat the same meal every day.
I'll tell you where. It's this really terrific young writer named Joe Pinsker at The Atlantic.
Oh, it's The Atlantic. Oh, great.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a great piece.
So they talk about how there are very few surveys on this, but apparently 17% of the Brits have eaten the exact same lunch every day for 2 years. They talk about this guy who was eating a peanut butter sandwich every day for 25 years. Another indicated a third of Brits ate the same lunch daily. I have the exact same breakfast every single day, 7 days a week, and I've done it for years.
What is it, Jim?
I do the egg white omelet with turkey, sausage, and onion.
There
I do
you
it
go.
Every single day. Sometimes with scallion if I run out of onion. Don't make faces. And I used to, as you know, used to ridicule me.
It's
my mother
to
used to make me
face.
A Hebrew National salami sandwich to go to bed with every
That's
single
right.
night. That lasted for years.
Extra piece of salami.
And your friend, who's the famous, I always mispronounce her name, the famous nutritionist from NYU.
Marion Nestle.
Nestle. I always say Nestle. Marion Nestle says there's nothing wrong with this. As long as it's healthy, variety is not necessary. Healthfulness is the goal. Where are you on this eating the same meal kind of thing? I love it.
You know, here
it simplifies your life. It saves you time.
Joe Pitzker is so good at deciding what is going to be a meme. So this was the most read piece on the Atlantic site, and it makes one point. The same breakfast every day isn't going to kill you, Jim Browdy, and everybody is so reassured. As something that Marion Nestle and none of the nutritionists pointed out, but I, with my great Tuss Friedman nutrition knowledge, will say is eating the same thing every day guards against overeating. Because if you vary your diet all the time, you tend not to have a kind of innate sense of portion control.
Ooh.
And so you eat more stuff if you're constantly varying your diet. And that's why, for example, when you're on a cruise ship, you're not only exposed to constant food, you're exposed to different kinds of food. It's part of the dangers of the buffet table.
Can I make another argument for this? This is mentioned in Pinsker's piece. Is it a stress reducing?
Stress reducing. I
it
love that part.
It takes me roughly 30 minutes a day to prepare when we're not at the library, because we eat the news feed. We do. What is wrong with that?
30 minutes.
It takes, because I
to
like...
To make his breakfast.
It's not my breakfast and my lunch, right?
Yeah.
My late afternoon meal.
Health-preserving pastime.
What's so funny about this?
Marjorie, you should preserve and celebrate this.
Okay, 30 minutes does seem excessive to me.
If you were making
a souffle or cooking a steak for dinner or something, but it does seem a lot.
Well, actually, I made a souffle this morning.
Okay.
No, I didn't.
Honorable.
Can I get this point out?
I'm sorry.
Part of the 30 minutes is not the preparation. It's the stress about deciding what I'm going to make or what I'm going to prepare for this particular day. If you go into the day knowing I'm having the exact same egg white omelet, which I love, by the way, excuse me, every single day. What's the matter with this?
Here's
and
the point.
Same lunch.
The most important point you just said was, you love it.
I love
you
it. I love it.
You continue to enjoy it. You know exactly the portion you want. You know exactly how to do it.
Exactly.
It's very relaxing.
Thank
I think
you.
It's great.
Thank
okay.
you very much for that.
Okay. No, I think the stress reducing part is very important. And I think the thing is you go in trends. And the trend this year for you, and I picked up on this, is the grape nuts.
And that was this year. Let's go last year.
Last
now, for a
year
woman who's ridiculing me.
It was the stone rolled oats last year.
When I was eating every single day for breakfast.
Stone cut.
Every
stone
single
cut,
day for
me.
A year. Not for a year. For like 2 years. The last couple of years up until my egg white phenomenon. I was eating oatmeal with melted bananas
That's
on
right.
it. That's right. So it was such a horrible idea. Who started bringing in oatmeal with melted bananas every single day?
He told me about this, and he was absolutely right. It was absolutely great.
If you microwave the bananas,
they
melt
onto the oatmeal.
And it becomes this wonderful sugary experience.
Right.
It's fabulous.
But this year we switched to grape nuts.
We did. Well, no, I actually switched to egg whites
and sausage.
You have
so suddenly lost
turkey sausage.
Okay. Microwave banana glaze.
No, by the way, if you make like 5 or 7 oatmeals in mason jars in a row, which I used to in the weekend, and then you bring them to work to put in the microwave and you put sliced banana on top, the banana melts into the sugary, beautiful, what's the matter with that thing?
No, I believe you. I want to add some brown sugar.
Well, you add whatever the hell you want. Okay. I'm just telling
Me
you
too.
That's what we were doing for a couple of years.
Maple syrup.
Yeah.
Okay. So as Jim said at the beginning, because people are very concerned about Brexit, apparently there's this massive hoarding of pre-Brexit liquor and all sorts of food and household goods and toilet paper and everything
this
else.
This is hitting the English where they live.
Yes.
And that is, don't remove their access to French wine. So this is hundreds and hundreds of years old, that the thing the English value about the French is their ability to make and sell wine. That's it. And they all have been having these buying trips to the wine regions and kept the French wine industry alive for centuries.
Did you see that if you spend a certain amount, I don't know if it's 250 pounds or whatever, 250 something, most of the liquor outlets or wine outlets in France will pay for your ferry ride or whatever that thing is, the tunnel.
The channel,
right. Yeah. So I love that kind of thing.
Okay, Corby, this is really fun.
By the way, you never said, have you ever done one of these same meal things every single day for a long period of time, or is that beneath you? What's the deal?
It's so not beneath me, but we're going to get into my embarrassing eating habits on another show.
Oh,
like maybe
next
never.
Week. Oh, that'd be
fabulous. I bet you have the same breakfast every day. I think that's the one.
I'm just not at liberty to say.
How's
right
never?
Now.
Is never good for you?
It's really good
Best
for
cartoon,
me.
Best cartoon, Bob Mankoff in history. Thank you very much.
Corby Cummer, thank you very much.
See you, Corby.
Corby Cummer joins us every week. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, an award-winning food writer, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy. Coming up, move over Acela. Could the Tesla be a better way to travel between Boston and New York for $99? Travel writer Christopher Muther is here for that and much more. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live at the Boston Public Library.